Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am your host, Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And as always, we really appreciate everybody joining us here today for another live edition of Midrats. And if you're with that distinguished group that is joining us live, if you'd like to, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room where you can join in with some of the usual suspects. And if you have some observations during the course of the show, or if there is a question you would like for us at some time in the next hour to direct to our guest, you can put it in there. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we'd love to grab your questions and fold them in as we move forward. If you got to run off halfway during the show, you want to catch up on what you missed, you can always get the full archive right away over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can just take a shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes and Stitcher and listen at your leisure. Now let's go ahead and dive in to the show. And as we look at the Syrian civil war, as it appears to be headed towards its end game, or at least another chapter, one old player on the scene is emerging stronger than ever. And that's a point of concern for all the nations in the area, and as a byproduct, the United States and her allies as well. What we want to do today is we're going to talk about Hezbollah and how the Syrian civil war has changed that organization and what we should expect going forward from her in the area as she emerges as an even more important player than she's already been. And for the full hour to discuss this and more, we have as our guest, Suleyma Anderson. Suleyma is a journalist and author based between New York City and Beirut, Lebanon. She's an alumna of Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, and she writes on a regular basis for Newsweek, The Atlantic, New York, Harper's, Foreign Policy, Vice, The Village Voice, and Vox.com. She's also the author of a book. Her first book came out in 2016, The Hostage's Daughter, and you can find links to that over at the show page. But we're going to use her latest article in Newsweek, Hezbollah's New Strength Leaves Israel Border Tense, as a starting point for our conversation. And with that out of the way, Suleyma, welcome to Midrats.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, we're really happy to bring you on board. And I think I'll turn the first question over to Eagle One. I think he has a nice scene setter for us.
Sure.
Yeah, about a million years ago, back in the middle of the late 60s, I visited Beirut and Lebanon and Syria and that area. And in those days, Lebanon was a beautiful, peaceful country, renowned for the coexistence of the various populations that it had. You know, there were the Christians, Maronite Christians, the Muslims of various kinds. Kind of tell us what happened to Lebanon that they ended up as they are today, if you can track through that.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I don't mean to correct you, but in the 1960s, while things seemed to be peaceful and there was coexistence and all that, and there certainly was, you know, the economy was in much better shape, and this was pre-Civil War, so, you know, it seems utopian now, but those sectarian tensions have been simmering since before Lebanon was even a country. And the problem, I think, was that each sect was, the primary sects were sponsored by, players, larger international players. So, you know, from the beginning, the founding of Lebanon, the French had their interests in Lebanon, and then, you know, Iran, and as it came, you know, Russia, the United States, every single, you know, major world player has had some sort of interference in Lebanese politics, practically. So, you know, I think that's the main issue, really.
And one of the things that emerged has been around for a long time, and one thing that really brought me attention to your article is, for obvious reasons, for the last decade and a half, most Americans, when they think of Islamic organizations that have been designated as terror organizations, they think of Al-Qaeda, its affiliates, the Islamic State, Caliphate, whatever you want to refer to them as. And while that has been the top of the mind, but Hezbollah has been around since the 1980s, and it has some deep roots in the area, but it's very, very different than Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, the Islamic States, which is one of the reasons why they're fighting them. So talk a little bit for the listeners so they better understand why when they hear Hezbollah, they should look at it slightly different, and that as far as its morphology and its relationship to the areas at which it exists.
Absolutely. I think that's a very good point. You know, in America, what we don't get a whole lot of detail necessarily about terrorism and terrorist groups and terrorists in general. We tend to sort of paint them all with the same brush. And in reality, they're very different organizations. And you know, when Hezbollah started out, there were factions of it, you know, that were involved in terrorism. And actually, one of their acts of terror was to kidnap and hold my father for almost 7 years as a hostage. This was a pre-Hezbollah Shia militia that eventually became absorbed by Hezbollah. And so these roots, they have roots in terrorism, but over the past few decades, they have transformed themselves, you know, from a ragtag group of resistance fighters to the most powerful non-state actor in the Middle East, possibly in history, or in recent history. They're incredibly successful politically, militarily. They've really, you know, spread. Now they're starting to spread their training and their military prowess across the Middle East. So yes, they are very different from a group like Al Qaeda or ISIS, you know, that are not part of the state, you know, of a functioning government. Whereas Hezbollah controls most of the government in Lebanon now. The president is an ally of theirs. You know, so it's you know, you can't think of them as you know, people who are going to send people to blow up buildings and stuff. That's just, I mean, you know, there are arguments and there have been cases and plots and things like that. I don't want to get into all the details, but it's a different animal overall.
Well, is it a different animal because it is morphed over time in the sense that, you know, I think that at least a precursor to Hezbollah was involved in the U.S. Embassy bombing and the Beirut
right.
barracks bombing. And in capturing your father, part of their protest was against the Israelis and the U.S. involvement in that area at the time. So, as this truly morphed into more of a quasi government, or is it still using the threat of terrorism as a factor in their business?
I don't think so, that they're using. I mean, I think the threat is always sort of an undercurrent to any sort of understanding we have of Hezbollah. But as I see it, no, I don't think that they it wouldn't serve their purposes to, you know, create an international, you know, terrorism attack. It wouldn't. Their interests now are consolidating power and spreading it in the Middle East as a armed force and as a political entity. So they need to legitimize, and blowing up, you know, buildings and things like that is not the way to do that. So I think their priorities are different now. I think, you know, the difficulty of sorting out, you know, what happened genesis is that it was a very chaotic time. We didn't have, our intelligence community didn't have a whole lot of insight into the formation of Hezbollah. I spent 3 years reporting on this for my book, and I found that it was actually quite a bit more complicated, I think, than the narrative has become.
course, you can't really understand Hezbollah unless you understand how those Shia militias interfaced with the Israeli invasions of Lebanon. Because when you look at the map, which is always very complicated, of Lebanon, of which sectarian group is located which, it's the Shias that are on the Israeli border more than any other. So talk a little bit, if you could, about, I don't know if radicalize is the right word, maybe unify is, or how the Israeli invasion of Lebanon helped give rise to Hezbollah.
Oh, that's a great question. So the interesting thing is there are stories, anecdotes, but a couple of them, of when the Israelis first came into Lebanon in 82, that the Shia welcomed them, that they actually said, there's stories of them throwing rice and rose water at Israeli tanks or something, because they hated the Palestinians at that point. You know, there had been civil war in Lebanon for some time, and it's at this point the factions, the Palestinian faction and the Shia factions were you know, fighting a lot. And so they weren't opposed necessarily, not all of them, I'm sure this is like a generalization, but there wasn't that kind of unified resistance to them that would emerge after the invasion. And, you know, by all accounts, you know, Israel made some serious mistakes in the way that they treated South Lebanon, which galvanized the Shia population against them. And, you know, ended up becoming an enemy that probably their number one military threat at the moment.
I've seen some indications in my reading for this show that Hezbollah is linked to the former Ayatollah Khomeini pretty heavily. Is that part of the factors that abetted their growth?
Oh, well, they've been an Iranian project from the outset. Basically, in the 80s, after the Israeli invasion, you know, Shia groups started to come together, militias, and resist the Israelis. And Iran saw an opportunity there because this was at a point where, you know, the revolution was still very fresh in people's minds. There was a lot of fervor to get it exported elsewhere, and they saw, you know, an opportunity, so they sent the officers from the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and trained these militias and created a unified force. So yes, that relationship goes way back and is very, very, very strong. In fact, to this day, Hezbollah receives, untold amounts of money from Iran, which is why, you know, there are these, it's just a segue, but you have these cases like, you know, in America, of people arresting people for smuggling cigarettes on behalf of Hezbollah or something, which is quite funny to anybody who understands exactly how much money they get from Iran and the fact that they have no need for, you know, small time criminal projects. I just find on a personal level, you know, you have to examine their relationship with Iran to understand what kind of criminal activity would and would not serve their interests.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to fund many wars with smuggling cigarettes, but
no.
You know, everybody needs a hobby, I guess. For those who got that idea. I think what's also interesting about Hezbollah is when you look at the demographic makeup of Lebanon, and I know that can be problematic just to look at numbers, though it used to be majority Christian, it's now only 40% Christian, roughly, you know, 27% Shia, 27% Sunni, the Druze that many people remember from our interaction in the 1980s, about 5.5%. But they've managed to take that 27% of the population, in a large part due to the muscle that Hezbollah can provide, and have leveraged that politically to be the kingmakers, if not the kings themselves, in Lebanon. Was there a couple of personalities or players? There had to be more to it than just Iranian money that allowed a minority population like that to get in such a powerful position.
Yeah, I think the Secretary General before Nasrallah, Hassan Nasrallah, who is the present one, was Mousawi was a very influential figure. But I would say that the real player in this in Hezbollah's formation, the man who has taken it to the heights that he has, is Nasrallah. I think he has seen the group through its transformation and led it into a place that's quite different from where it began.
Is Hezbollah also involved in civic projects, shall we say, to enhance their reputation internally? And how does that work out?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, so that's the other thing. They provide social services. They, they keep their, they take very good care of their own community, the Shia community, because that's really where their strength lies. If they lose their followers in the Shia community, then they lose a lot of their power, if not all, because their base is so ideologically aligned. They're true believers, that's what makes Hezbollah such a good match in a way, not ideologically, they're totally different, but a good military match for ISIS because, they have that ideological fervor that they're not afraid to die for, for their beliefs, which is, you have to have that to fight an enemy like ISIS that is not afraid to die either. The group itself is extremely it's so much more than we understand in America. They've also done their work in Syria has been in many ways very troubling from a humanitarian perspective. They they've participated in starvation sieges in places like Madaya. So this is not a group that they're not. They have plenty of blood on their hands. It's from a militia type level as opposed to a kind of ISIS terrorist level.
And we were talking before also about the funding as it comes from Iran. And obviously, when you take the king's shilling, you take the king's bidding, and there is some of that going on. But at a point a few years ago in the Syrian civil war, when Assad was really on his heels, it was the little back from Russia, the little back from Hezbollah, a little back from some Iranian forces that helped him get his footing back. How much of Hezbollah's decision to move its fighting formations into Syria to back up Syria was simply doing the king's bidding because they took the king's shilling, and how much of it was a recognition that the Assad regime, which from the Alawite, who people have done an entire PhD on just what the Alawites are in the Shia world, and how much of that was just recognizing that there was another religious minority next door that was in danger of being crushed and scattered, that led them to make that decision to move in?
Oh, I think for certain the decision was more calculated from a military and a political perspective than it would be from any sort of sense of camaraderie with another sect in another country. I think maybe there's some of that, but what you have to think about is yes, Iran played a big role in that decision, and in every decision Hezbollah makes, frankly, they run their own game internally, in that Iran doesn't overtly meddle in the day-to-day politics of Lebanon as they relate to Hezbollah, unless they see that that it's necessary to preserve their interests. That being said, it almost certainly any major military move that Hezbollah makes would have to be with the blessing of Iran, and the strong participation of that country in the decision making process. I think, but at the same time, Hezbollah had to preserve their weapons pipeline from Iran, through Syria. So preserving the Assad regime was very much in their own interest as well. So it just happened that, you know, it was an order that they had to take for their own well-being as well.
What can we understand anything that's going on in the Middle East without understanding what the end games of the various players are? I mean, do we have to understand what Iran is up to, what they're trying to do by getting, access to the Mediterranean overland? And the same thing with Russia. Can we understand what they're up to supporting Hezbollah and the Assad government without knowing what their end game is?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of analysis and work that goes into figuring out what their end games are. And I'm sure, you know, and a lot of it is very, very complicated, too complicated to go through right now. But I think it is important to understand what the end game is. But you also, in terms of thinking about the end game, you also have to think about that a lot of these policies are reactionary or anticipatory. So for Iran, and it's a lot of competition, you know, between Sunni and Shia and America and Russia. These dynamics play out in a way that sometimes I'm not so clear if they actually have a coherent end goal, you know. But sometimes I wonder if we have a coherent end goal politically. So sometimes I wonder if anyone does, you know. But I think a lot of it is you have to look at it as it fits into the regional dynamic to understand what their motivations are. So in terms of Iranian influence across the Middle East, you know, sort of spearheaded by Hezbollah, and that they're training Shia militias in Iraq and even in Yemen and places where they see opportunities to nurture Shia populations. And why do they do this? I mean, I think a lot of it is just is to maintain a sense of control versus their, you know, versus the Sunnis, versus Saudi Arabia, versus America. So it's, a lot of it is competition. And of course, they have their own, you know, other interests, very complicated, sort of reasons for doing the things that they do. But I just think that you have to look at it through the lens of the relationships between the different players.
Yes, I think that's a fair critique for everybody having a long-term plan. But you know, one of the players in the region that at least seems to be trying to figure out what are the next two or three chess moves down the road, and that's Israel. Israel, and mm-hmm. they have been the last few days, they've been doing strikes into Syria. And most of their strikes into Syria specifically has been targeting what they believe are the movement of heavy weapons by Hezbollah or to Hezbollah, because they're looking at the next play down the road. What is your view on at least what's driving the Israelis' spotty but significant plays in the border area there in Syria against Hezbollah? Are they looking at a post-Syrian civil war situation where a newly armed and encouraged Hezbollah starts to make trouble on the border again?
I think that's very much a concern for Israel. But I mean, when you look at 2006, it was not a successful campaign for Israel. You know, it wasn't a devastating loss, but they were pushed back and their casualty count was way higher than they, you know, than they're used to or would prefer it to be. So in the time since 2006, Hezbollah has become, you know, increased its power, strength, influence, and military might just, you know, absolutely tenfold, if not more. It's become, you know, much, much better armed, much more of a threat. So it's a mistake to think that, you know, Israel could ever live with that scenario, you know, as the state, you know, knowing that threat is on their border. They, you know, it's untenable. They were always going to come back, as far as I was concerned. Like, I always knew it. And, you know, at this point, I think the problem is that because Hezbollah has become so strong, the Israelis know that they can't necessarily when another ground invasion will almost certainly, you know, not turn out well for them. And they know that the price they're going to pay for a war with Hezbollah is going to be higher than, I mean, in the end they will win, you know, because they are the most powerful army in the Middle East, but they will suffer many casualties and infrastructure damage and all those things. So, knowing that, a lot of Israelis, I interviewed one for my piece, a lot of Israeli generals, and I think even, other like current officials in the IDF have made it clear that they will target Lebanese infrastructure and the Lebanese government in the next war, which in 2006 they tried to make it a policy, to just target Hezbollah. Basically, the next war is going to be much, much more devastating for Lebanon, and I believe for the regional balance. And that's because at this point Hezbollah has become a really frightening enemy in a way to Israel. Because of proximity, and because they just keep getting stronger.
I thought it was interesting in your article, if I remember correctly, that one of the people you interviewed was talking about how the U.S. removal of Saddam Hussein actually has created this sort of vacuum that everybody's racing to fill. Is that a real belief, you think, or is that just one of those talking points?
Oh, I think he was mostly being kind of ironic in that. But this guy's always telling me, we have America to thank. They keep screwing up in the Middle East and like giving us these like great, opportunities, which is an interesting way of thinking about it. But I think the point is, and he's right about that, in that our actions in the Middle East have, definitely put our own interests at risk, and I think made it possible for Iran and others to get a foothold in the region and in a ways that perhaps that they would not have if the situation were more stable and if we had contributed in some way to the instability.
Not to play devil's advocate, which of course I'm going to do. not implying anybody's the devil here. I think everybody has a variety of horns on their head. But when it comes to the whenever you talk about Iran and Hezbollah, you've got to go back to the religious underpinning of it. And Iran's the big Shia power, but Iran's the only, unless you really want to bean count on some of the smaller coastal states, at least from a political power standpoint. Iran's the only Shia nation state around, but Shias, correct me if I'm wrong, I think they're like 15% of all Muslims are Shia. I think it's some percentage of that, but they all are scattered around in Lebanon, Syria. Of course, we have what's going on in Yemen and, the Hazara of central Afghanistan and a few other places. Mm-hmm. And the argument has been made that a lot of what Iran is doing, because without a majority, they're not really going to be able to build rebuild the Persian Empire, so to speak. But there's an aggressive defense as a response to Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, in that variation of fundamentalist Sunni. The Shia are as infidel as anybody else, and those horrific videos that we saw in northern Iraq were they were putting bullets in the head of dozens of people and dumping them in the river. Those were Shia. Is there some opportunity there? We've done this a little bit, but not too much, because there is a lot of bad blood between us and the Iranians. But is there an opportunity here to maybe step back a bit and to recognize that not everything that Iran is doing might be as awful and terrible as some say, and could actually be understandable, and as such is something that you could work with them to, if not contain, at least to avoid it becoming something that would be a little more difficult to live with?
Yeah, I think, it's wise to acknowledge I personally think that on a personal level, I tend to mistrust all political actors everywhere, but particularly in the Middle East. But I think that, you know, when it comes to, for example, terrorism, Iran is often, you know, often frequently cited as the number one sponsor of terrorism when that's actually not the case. You know, when you look at the funding for ISIS and Al-Qaeda, most of it has come from the Gulf. So and that funding and that push, whether it, you know, did or did not directly concern the governments of these countries, it was a part, an overall part of the Sunni Shia proxy war. You know, people in the Gulf, you know, some certain very religious, you know, Sunni Muslims didn't want to see Iran get a foothold in Syria, and they decided to, you know, combat that by funding radical militant groups, which eventually grew into this into ISIS. So some of it is in reaction to that. At the same time, and I think the defensive posturing that you bring up is very important. The Shia have long been a very persecuted minority in many places, and there's this very much the sense that I get of you know, nobody is going to push us around anymore. That sort of cultural feeling to it, and I think it's, in many ways, it's almost similar when you think about it to the Israeli government. In many ways, that kind of just sort of us against the world mentality, and I think there are opportunities to work with. I mean, look, we may not directly coordinate with Iranian-sponsored groups like Hezbollah in the war against ISIS, but you know, we're fighting the same enemy in the same place. So there has to be some sort of, you know, dynamic that goes on there, and I don't know the extent of it, but there has to be some communication through, you know, a middleman, through, you know, however it needs to happen. And I think the reason that we don't seize these opportunities to maybe, you know, find maybe not common ground, but at least find some dialogue in some way to work with Iran and its proxies. Part of it is that, you know, they are what Iran and Hezbollah have done in Syria is, you know, it is not a simple thing to swallow. They've assisted Assad in some really horrible, heinous crimes against humanity. So, you know, there's that. But I think a lot of it is also political. It would be very difficult to find a politically appealing way to say we're going to work with Hezbollah, you know.
Is it possible, given the support that we give to Israel, to even contemplate some kind of deal, you know, where, or is that just out of the question?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we saw with the last administration that it was much more willing to go there than this administration. I don't think in this climate that it's at all, you know, not even the faintest possibility, really. But yeah, I mean, I think from a strategic standpoint, it would make more sense to try and work, you know, and at least work towards our long-term interests, and be that, you know, if that means cooperating or not cooperating, maybe, but you know, establishing a dialogue. I mean, I think if that helps us in the long term, then, you know, then it's wise to consider. But it's not going to happen right now.
My next question, I think, almost might be answered better by somebody that knows the Game of Thrones book a lot better.
Oh, you've come to the right place, sir.
Well, perfect. We'll have to figure out what everybody's sigil is any moment now. But when you look about, speaking of communicating and cooperating, when you look at the border of the Golan Heights, there is an interesting stew of players there. In that little triangle corner where the border of the Golan Heights comes with the modern Syrian border, the Jordanian border, there's a pocket of the Islamic State forces there. But as you go north of the border, it's a mixed mash of various rebel forces, forces loyal to Assad, Hezbollah mixed in there as well. And of course, there's Israel on the opposite side of that. Have we seen any type of effective deconfliction or communications between those parties involved that can kind of try to keep that do that's going on there to be at least relatively contained, or do these parties just not want to talk to each other and they make it up as they go along?
I think probably the latter. I think, you know, there are obviously some coordination between, you know, they have to, again, if they're all sort of coexisting in this small space, there has to be some sort of, you know, a shifting alliance and things like that. But overall, I think you're right. I think it's a real problem zone. Israel just shot a Hezbollah drone supposedly from that area. It's a very tense place. And we don't hear a lot coming out of it, actually. But I do think it's going to be some place that we'll have to watch in terms of a potential future conflict.
You know, I keep looking at the history of this area and looking at especially the Ottoman Empire, which controlled so much of this territory from the 13th century to the 20th century, early 20th century. And also tying this, you know, the Iranian stuff with the great game of the 19th century. And I'm just thinking that are we seeing the end of the reaction to the fall of the Ottoman Empire? Is just continuing as these nation states, which didn't even exist 80 years ago, are beginning to either fall apart because they were never really meant to be, or is this just something that the Ottoman Empire doesn't have anything to do with? Not a great question.
It is a good question, and I think, you know, that people put too much emphasis on Sykes-Picot, on the treaty that divided the Middle East pretty much between the French and the British, as a precursor to the current conflicts and tensions that exist. I tend to think that it makes perfect sense to look at that sort of moment as the genesis for these conflicts. I mean, they're obviously the sectarian tensions in the Middle East, they didn't start with Sykes-Picot. They go back further, but the sort of arbitrary division of the Middle East and, creation, as you said, of nation states that included many sects that hated each other, didn't get along, and just, sort of expecting them to suddenly make a country together, it definitely had a lot of really awful consequences. But at the same time, I think, there are many, many other reasons since Sykes-Picot for why the Middle East has become as fractured and divided as it is. And I think we, as Americans, what would help us in the long term is to look at our role in the history of the region, the mistakes we've made. And I think that unless we acknowledge that we've made mistakes, we won't learn from them and nothing will change. But, and not in a way that, absolves everyone else of blame, but in a way that's what did we do here that created a situation in which radicalism can flourish? Because we've done that many times. I can name, at least three or four examples off the top of my head, and the most obvious being Iraq. But others, like even in Iran, we supported a coup against a democratically elected leader. We supported the Shah, which led many Iranians into the arms of the Ayatollahs. And, so time and time again, and even much more recently than that, we've made decisions that have gone against our long-term interests in the Middle East. And I think unless we really at least examine these events and our role in them critically, then nothing is going to change. And I think that's what we're seeing right now, sadly.
Even if you recognize that you can never do anything about the past, but what you can do is modify the present and position things for the future. And, we find ourselves at the end of 2017 in a place that a lot of people had lost bets on a few years ago. We have a not insignificant amount of U.S. military forces, not just flying over Syria, but on the ground in Syria, helping out. Okay. In a variety of ways of certain sectarian groups against the Islamic State. Now, you mentioned a little bit of history of our involvement in the area. Are there some things that we're doing now in Syria that you see either fit that pattern of some strategic mistakes or perhaps something that could turn out to be a net positive? I know it's hard to predict how history will judge a decision or another. Or do you see a repeat of previous patterns or something a little different with our boots on the ground in Syria?
Well, that's a great question. I think the number one thing that I'm seeing is, just as an overall idea of the environment we're in, you know, how many billions of dollars, I don't remember the exact number, but just got pumped into the U.S. military while our State Department is falling into disrepair. So there is an overwhelming emphasis now on the violent conflict, the crushing military power of the United States, but not a whole lot of investment in diplomacy and how we are going to exist in those regions after the conflicts are over, which, you know, is supposedly the point. And I think something that I'm seeing that's a huge problem as well is the huge rise in military, in civilian casualties since, in this administration. I forget the exact number, but it's just absolutely jumped from the Obama years. And that's a problem because when you think about, defeating radicalism in Iraq or Syria, you take somebody who's just lost his parents or his village or, all these orphans, all these family members losing people, and that unifies them, that makes them much more vulnerable to radicalization. So it's kind of like putting out one fire and creating 10. And I just think those mistakes are not going to be addressed or changed unless we start thinking of ourselves in the Middle East in a different way and not just in a, we're going to defeat our enemies and crush them beneath our feet, but also how do we win wars? How do we exist in after we've won? How do we prevent the wars from starting again? Those are all things that we are not really addressing, I don't think.
Well, it's an interesting question. Assuming, of course, that we're responsible for a lot of civilian deaths, why do we share a greater burden than the Syrian government, Hezbollah has done, what the ISIS people have done? I mean, there are a lot of fingers to be pointed about who is responsible for all this stuff. That's right. Let me finish the question, which is there a way to point out, look, yes, we're trying to fight ISIS. Nobody likes ISIS. And in doing that, we've had to destroy the village in order to protect the village, sort of thing. Is there a way for us to publicize why we're doing what we're doing better than we've done to kind of hope we can change hearts and minds? Boy, Vietnam is strong in my brain today.
Oh, yeah. And I think, I just wanted to be clear. Sorry I interrupted you, but I just wanted to be clear that in absolutely no sense do I think we bear all the blame for the Middle East problems at all. I mean, when you look at things, like I said, that Hezbollah has done in Syria, that Iran has done in the region, nobody in that region or their sponsors doesn't have blood up to their elbows, but the point is that, instead of focusing just on the other and what they've done, I think just in terms of strategy, it will behoove us to examine our role in the region in a more critical way, as opposed to just sort of assuming that we're, riding in on a white horse every time, and we have right on our side, and that kind of thinking doesn't get us anywhere, or at least it hasn't so far. But yeah, I think I guess your original question, is there ways we could be publicizing it better? I think. Yes, look, civilian casualties are an inevitability of war. But, there are ways to do it that minimize those casualties, as opposed to, so far, Obama's strategy, which seems to have been, relatively successful, and this administration hasn't really changed it in a hugely impactful way, other than escalating. But the strategy of training and supporting local actors against a group like ISIS, I think is a solid one, as opposed to mounting an invasion and being the occupier and the oppressor and giving, you know, the terrorists and the you know, evil, you know, fundamentalists sort of a boogeyman to galvanize their people against. I think, you know, we should be a supportive force and actually acknowledge and respect the sovereignty of you know, the actors that we support. I think that's important.
Well, let me follow up on that, because if we continue to support local actors, you know, we support various groups like the Kurds, mm-hmm. are we in danger of creating or at least enlarging the mess that's there now down the road? Have we just kicked the can a little bit further down the road, or is it possible that all this will be peacefully resolved if we had a good State Department effort?
Well, I mean, I think at this point it's so complex and difficult that, no, there's not going to be an easy solution, even if we had a robust and functioning State Department. It's going to still be a huge challenge. But I guess my point is that, you know, the problems that we've, how do I put this? I mean, I don't have a whole lot of optimism for the region, sadly. And I think it would be very difficult to have it. At the same time, I just think that the ways that we've been thinking and acting until this point have not served us very well. And I think that, you know, it would be in our benefit to try and think and analyze and make policy based on different mindsets than we have been. I think that we should at least try it, because what we've done so far has not worked out well.
One thing that Shia Islam and specifically Hezbollah does have a history with is, if not respect, at least developing partnerships with other religious minorities. You know, one of the things with the Islamic State and a lot of the Sunni organizations that we consider terrorist is it's their way or the highway, so to speak. Whereas the Shia leadership in Syria has done a pretty good job, because they are a religious minority, protecting the Druze, protecting the Christian minority populations. And in Lebanon, we've seen Hezbollah, at least politically and sometimes militarily, partner with some of the Christians as well. As we see if we assume that the tide continues the direction that it's going, does that pretend, if not so much Hezbollah, perhaps the other Shia leadership there, that as opposed to a situation where the Islamic State would have continued to take most of Syria and the resulting mass killings that took place, the areas that they did contain, that advance of the Assad regime towards outside of the Kurdish-controlled areas, getting back control of their country in partnership with Hezbollah, that we should see a protection of minority rights, not just for the obviously Shia sects, but also for the Christians and the Druze and other minorities?
You know, I think a lot of that is, you know, you're right. I think especially in Lebanon, Hezbollah has partnered with Christian political actors. You know, they've protected Christian villages from ISIS, things like that. And, you know, I think, and your point about the Kurds in Syria is really interesting, because I feel like that's going to be the next real conflict to watch, you know, between Assad's forces and the Kurds. I think that's going to be, you know, the conflict of the future, perhaps. But I think Hezbollah is what it's doing in Syria, and with the Christians in Lebanon, it's all very calculated. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, they don't feel some sort of responsibility. Perhaps they do. I don't know. But a lot of it is you know, to consolidate power, to forge alliances, to increase their influence and their strength and become more and more of a dominating force in the country. And the thing is about Hezbollah, When you look at the history, you know, Israel, I believe Israel invaded Lebanon three times before Hezbollah even existed. So for those who say, you know, there would be no Israel wouldn't be a threat if there were no Hezbollah, I mean, you know, that's not borne out by history. However, at the same time, there can, for anyone interested in a free, independent Lebanon as a state, you know, a strong national institution with an armed force that, you know, is sustainable and all that, Hezbollah is incompatible with that. So it's this dynamic between, you know, Hezbollah is needed in some way as the protector of Lebanon now, especially with the ISIS threat that was really exacerbated. You know, we're the protectors of Lebanon. We're the, you know, we're going to, it's just us between you and them, was very much the message that Lebanese were getting, especially the Christians, because they were literally on the front line. They were almost part of the caliphate. You know, that would have been a horrific fate for them. So, you know, you have to look at these things as calculated political and strategic moves as well.
Well, I think you raise also a really good point about the military strength of Hezbollah as compared to the Lebanese army. From what I understand, Hezbollah's got more missiles than almost any country, missiles and mortar rounds and stuff that are capable of going into Israel than almost any other country except the U.S. How is there a chance the Lebanese government through its military could ever constrain Hezbollah, or has that ship sailed?
Oh, it sailed. I think. It was never really. I mean, I guess in the beginning, and it's an infancy, but even then, you know, Lebanon was consumed by conflict, and there was no real national state to speak of. And in recent history, absolutely not. There's and you know, other countries, America, Saudi Arabia, have made you know, overtures to strengthen the army, to train it, to fund it, in order to counter Hezbollah's influence. And it hasn't seemed, I don't think, although other analysts have said differently, but I don't think that it's seen a whole lot of success in that, you know, you saw the latest border battles, which I wrote about, between the Lebanese army and then ISIS on the border and then Hezbollah in Syria. And it was a coordinated, maybe not a joint operation, but certainly a coordinated operation between the Lebanese army, Hezbollah, and the Syrian army. And, you know, you see just the level to which, you know, the people, or is it the people, the army, the resistance, I think is like a slogan of theirs, that Hezbollah is very much trying to project this unity with the Lebanese army and you know, this idea that they're not there to interfere with the day-to-day lives of Lebanese. You know, they don't want an Islamic state. They're not interested in any of that. And which is true as far as, you know, to a certain extent. I don't think that their ultimate goal is to achieve another Iran and Lebanon, maybe ultimately, but certainly it's a very practical, calculating organization in that's not a priority for them. They would rather just, you know, quietly control Lebanon from the shadows, I think.
Well, I'll take you from your informed optimism to my comfortable place, which is informed pessimism. But because just one of the myriad of ways in the near term this would probably work out, I'm going to make some very big planning assumptions here. But let's say that Assad exerts control over the rest of Syria, comes to some accommodation with the Sunni population. The Kurdistan issue, at least for the moment, hasn't flared up at all. Mm-hmm. Israel, relatively staying within its borders, isn't going to bother anybody. And so Hezbollah is no longer needed in Syria. They go back home, armed to the teeth, flush with victory. I mean, is that really a formula for Hezbollah just to go back to their village and tend their vineyards? Or, you know, what are some of the follow-ons to that that at least concern you the most? Maybe not the one you think is most likely to take place, but that's a pretty wicked stew that they would come home with.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I've seen that, you know, in interviewing them over the course of the last year, I've seen them become ever more confident, ever more, sure that they can take on all comers, even Israel. They are very, very, they have a lot of bravado, but they mean it, you know, they're very serious. And I guess, but I would also point out that, you know, Israel has carried out a number of strikes against Hezbollah in Syria. And, you know, up until this point, Hezbollah has not reacted to the provocations. So I think that indicates that they're not, actively searching to provoke a conflict. That might change, especially, you're right, with the flush of victory, with, the increasing tensions that are happening. And really when Even the most practical calculating organization, when driven into a corner, can do things that are maybe not in its long-term interest. So especially an actor, you know, so ideologically fueled as Hezbollah. So, yeah, I mean, anything's possible. I definitely think that that the focus is going to shift to the tensions and a potential conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. I think that has been a danger for, you know, since 2006. And I don't think that I don't think people who say, you know, it's been calm for years now and it's going to stay that way. I mean, I just don't think that's a real possibility given the circumstances.
Well, I'd like to be more optimistic, but I tend to agree with you. And let me thank you for coming on today and engaging us in a give and take on the show. And as always, we'd like to give you the opportunity to talk about anything you got coming up. And we didn't even ask you about your book, but anything you want to talk about that you're working on, and when we can expect to see it, and where we should be looking.
Right now I just put out the NBC piece that you mentioned about the tensions on the Israeli border. I'd like to talk about my book briefly if I could. It's part memoir, part investigation of my father's kidnapping and captivity by terrorists in Lebanon. And for it, I spent about a year interviewing one of my father's captors, who is now part of Hezbollah. So, you know, and it also includes my own experience, you know, how my father's kidnapping affected my life and sort of the toll it took personally. But it's about 75% investigative reporting of me, diving deeper into this world, and it kind of explains, you know, because I get a lot of accusations, Hezbollah would never talk to you, you know, you're making it up. It got so convoluted that, you know, I did a piece for Newsweek where I went into Syria and interviewed Hezbollah members, and people were saying that I staged the whole thing, you know, and I was just like, wow, if only I was paid that well. I guess my point is that the book sort of goes into how I built those contacts, how I found an in to this world that ended up, you know, being sort of a very strange, a situation for someone in my position to be in. But it has given me a lot of insight. Writing my book, what I always like to say is it gave me so much insight into how a terrorist is created. Because, you know, the man who kidnapped my father, it's all in the book, but I didn't know him. I didn't know who he was at first. He didn't know who I was. I was interviewing him for other pieces. So we had established a rapport before either one of us knew who the other was, which I think is why that, those interviews could even take place. It was so interesting to me to really speak to somebody who has been radicalized, who did, carry out acts of terrorism, and who, who regrets it later in life, and feels obviously, and I always like to say this, it's not about excusing or justifying what terrorists do. Nothing I ever do, excuses that, because it's not excusable. I mean, you're inflicting violence on innocent people. I don't really care what your reasons are. You shouldn't be doing it. At the same time, again, from a strategic standpoint, it really, really benefits us to think of these people as human beings instead of just monsters that are, you know, going to come out under our bed at night and, you know, kill our children and eat them. You know, the way we think about them needs to change, because unless we understand them as human, unless we sort of follow the thread of their radicalization and see where the points where interventions could have occurred, you know, then we're never going to stop these people from, you know, people from recruiting and radicalizing, you know, people like him. So, so that's what I would, say about my book. And, you know, I'd really, I appreciate you guys giving me the chance to talk about it.
Well, Sula Mae, we really appreciate you coming on today to talk to us for the show. And for the listeners, the book she was referring to went out in 2016, The Hostage's Daughter. You can find a link to that on the show page and also on our home blogs. And look forward to reading your stuff here in the future, and I hope you have a great week.
All right. Thanks. You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. And thank you very much, everybody, for listening to another episode of Midrats. Until next time, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Hi.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.